The Kevin Smith Show, unique in the galaxy.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous planet. It is indeed a gorgeous planet, and I, for one, am glad I'm here. I've taken a look at some of the others, and the conditions are pretty rough. Some of you are joining us for the very first time. Welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here, and I hope you make a habit out of this. It's a really good habit to get into. Last night, I first of all, let me apologize to the lady that called in late in the show, and she asked a question, and I said, we have to go to a break. I'll answer that when we come back. And then I didn't do it. It totally slipped my minuscule mind, and I just didn't do it. I apologize. And the answer to your question was about Ed Grimsley and James Gilliland. Ed Grimsley has the DVD out called UFO Wars, and he talks about seeing UFOs through night vision equipment, and they shoot at each other. They shoot beams of light out and sometimes blow each other up. James Gilliland, on the other hand, sees a lot of UFOs, and people who come to his ranch see UFOs, and his view of them is that they are all peaceful, and there's not none of that war stuff going on. And your question had to do with, do I know if they have ever gotten together and talked about this? Now, I'm going to tell you what I know. I know that, Ed Grimsley has talked with me before about James Gilliland, and I cannot remember if he said that he has talked to him or has not. I just don't know the answer to that question, but I do apologize that when we came back from break, I just skipped over that and didn't answer it. It was not on purpose, and I hope that you won't hold that against me. We are getting some pretty interesting UFO reports in here, and one of them came to me today from Japan. I want you to take a look pretty quickly. I'm almost out of time for this segment of the show, but there is a person in Japan by the name of Takashi Tahara, 49 years of age, and this Takashi Tahara, using a 300-millimeter lens on his camera, shot this picture of a helicopter. And you'll see there are two black dots in the sky. The one that is to the left is the one that he reports as being an orb that came in close to the helicopter. Here's the picture zoomed in, and you can see it does appear to be an orb shape. And so Takashi Tahara took that picture, and that helicopter is an MH-53E called a Sea Dragon. And this was on January the 17th. It happened at about 4 p.m., and so anyway, I do appreciate this being sent to me. Very interesting. We're getting a lot of reports about these orb or sphere-shaped small UFOs approaching aircraft and even the space shuttle. All right, we'll be back right after this break. My guest this evening is Dr. Michael Sala. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is someone that I suspect everyone in the audience already knows, and especially if you've been listening to the Kevin Smith Show for very long, you are familiar with Dr. Michael Sala. Dr. Michael Sala is a highly credentialed academic, and he has served on the teaching staff of a couple of different universities, big-name universities, and then he is the founder, and this is probably, for those of you who have come to know him in recent years, the last couple of years, he is the founder of exopolitics.org. Dr. Michael Sala, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Aloha, Kevin. I'm glad to be back.
And we do need to tell people that you are in Hawaii, and that's why you greeted me with the traditional Hawaiian greeting, aloha.
Sure am. It's a little wet here at the moment. Doesn't look like Hawaii, but definitely that's the spirit.
What time of day is it where you are?
Well, let's say a three-hour difference with the West Coast, so it's just 4 p.m. here.
Okay. Now, we've talked about a lot of different things when you've been with me on the show previously. We've talked about a lot of different topics having to do with exopolitics. And then I started following some articles that you have been writing and they've been published over at examiner.com. And these articles have to do with President Kennedy and the issues surrounding unidentified flying objects. Now, I have to tell you, when I first started reading these, my reaction at first was sort of, okay, ho-hum, here's some more Kennedy stuff. Because, you see, I grew up in Dallas, Texas. I knew people that were some way involved in that whole Kennedy thing. I don't want to say they were involved in the assassination, but in all of the events surrounding the assassination. The police officer that was killed by Oswald, or purportedly by Oswald, I knew him, and I knew his family, his kids. His daughter was my girlfriend. Of course, we were little bitty kids, but she was my girlfriend, and so I knew other people that were some way involved in that. And so, over the years, I've been inundated with all kinds of Kennedy information. So, when I first started following your articles, it was sort of okay. Well, here's some more Kennedy stuff. But I have to tell you, by about the third article, you had me awakened from my coma. And you have brought out some information that, on the one hand, is highly interesting, and I would think, on the other hand, may be even dangerous to you, Dr. Sala. But I'd like for us to talk about those articles tonight and talk about this connection that you have found between Kennedy and the UFO issue.
Right. Well, it's a fascinating case. I mean, I began doing the research on the Kennedy case and the relationship he had with some people who claimed to have had contact with extraterrestrials, and there were claims that he had met with George Adamski. And so I began to look at some of that literature, and it kind of took me on a journey. I mean, I didn't know where this was heading. And as I kind of dug deeper and deeper and looked at the documents, I found that there was an amazing synchronicity with some real historic events, really important events. And it really became clear to me towards the end of this series of articles that this was something that I thought was really neglected greatly by those who, on the one hand, have looked at the Kennedy assassination in depth in terms of what may have been the reason for him being assassinated, and those that maybe were interested in UFOs but not really kind of connecting the dots in terms of what happened with Kennedy. And I think that really what happened was that the very last 2 months of his administration, he confronted those that were in control of the UFO files, and he came up with a really ingenious way of getting the UFO files released. I think just understanding the historic development of the Kennedy administration, I think from the beginning he began the process of inquiring into what is known about the UFOs, making inquiries into different organizations within the U.S. military, the different agencies, kind of getting the runaround. And I think that by the end of his first 2 years in office, he understood that he wasn't getting anywhere, and he came up with an initiative that I thought was really amazing in terms of how to shake loose the UFO files that were very closely guarded secrets by the various intelligence organizations, and especially the CIA. So that's where I think there's a lot of benefit for people to kind of revisit the Kennedy case and the Kennedy assassination in terms of, well, what is the UFO connection?
All right. Now, let me sort of cut to the chase on something that really raised my eyebrows here. And this would be in the article that says CIA director, the title. CIA director issued secret directive denying President Kennedy access to UFO files. Now, in this article, there are a couple of things that really caused me to raise an eyebrow, and a couple of things that caused me to raise both eyebrows. Kennedy had sent, apparently, a presidential memorandum to the director of the CIA, instructing the director to share UFO files with their counterparts in the Soviet Union. And apparently Kennedy and Khrushchev had been talking on the hotline and talking about how they really needed to make sure that both sides understood UFOs as much as was possible so that they would not misinterpret UFO activity as a missile launch, thus triggering a nuclear war. Now, I don't find that to be so surprising. What I do find, though, that was really surprising is two statements that follow that in your article. And I'm quoting now from your article. It says, in responding to Kennedy's request, Angleton, and for our audience, Angleton was the CIA director at that time. So in responding to Kennedy's request, Angleton followed a secret directive from former CIA director Alan W. Dulles to ensure that under no circumstances would any U.S. president or his staff gain access to classified UFO files. How do we know about this secret directive if it was secret?
Well, a minor correction there, Kevin. Firstly, James Angleton was the chief of counterintelligence for the CIA. The director at the time was actually John McCone.
That is correct. You are correct. I'm sorry about that.
So that memo that you mentioned, that National Security Action Memo on November 12 of 1963, which, I mean, it needs to be pointed out again and again that this all happened 10 days before the assassination. So we're talking about pretty close to some of the very last executive actions President Kennedy ever took. And so one, and he actually issued a couple of National Security Action Memos on that day, and one you mentioned, which was to the director of the CIA, instructing the director to share UFO files with NASA so that NASA can basically fulfill its obligations for cooperating with the Soviet Union on joint space and lunar missions. And this is where we kind of encounter some real history here, which is, makes it very fascinating, because a lot of people, and I wasn't aware of this, I mean, it's just one of those historical facts that just kind of goes into the background and gets forgotten, is that on September 20 of 1963, President Kennedy actually spoke at the United Nations General Assembly and requested that the Soviet Union join the U.S. in joint space and lunar missions, that the so-called race to the moon, to get the first man on the moon, that Kennedy was not committed to that, that he, in fact, was holding out to the Soviet Union that let's do this together, let's join, cooperate, and let's kind of lessen Cold War hostilities. And what's really interesting was that at first the Soviet Union said no, they rejected that. But then what happened was that towards the end of October, the beginning of November of 63, Khrushchev had a change of heart. And we know that because his son, Sergei Khrushchev, actually gave some interviews in the U.S. where he talked about those days, and he did confirm that, yes, indeed, his father initially dismissed Kennedy's initiative, but then had a change of heart and accepted it. And so what we have here around November 12 of 1963 was a really historic set of events where Nikita Khrushchev and Kennedy reached agreement on joint space missions, a joint mission to the moon, and that part of this would entail sharing of UFO files so that they could lessen any misunderstandings, because in those days there was some very serious threats posed by mistaken identification of UFOs as a first nuclear strike from the other side. And incidentally, this was the very thing that Robert Dean said that NATO was greatly concerned about, and in fact in 1964 that NATO had commissioned a study that was released, which basically looked at the dangers of UFOs being mistakenly identified as a Soviet first strike. So this was a pretty major issue in the day, and so it all fits in that, yes, this was why Khrushchev and Kennedy were talking about UFOs, why it was that Khrushchev and Kennedy saw this as being a really important security component of their cooperation, and why it was that NASA would be tasked with the job of getting the UFO files declassified from the CIA and then share those with the Soviets, because this was all part of the way in which they could cooperate to fulfill the joint space mission. So there are some very real historic events associated with that, with those National Security Action Memos that were issued on November 12, 10 days before the Kennedy assassination.
Okay, but your article refers here to a previous memo that had been issued by CIA Director Alan Dulles, and it says that this memo was to ensure that under no circumstances would any U.S. president or his staff gain access to classified UFO files. How do we know about that secret internal memo? Has that been declassified? Is that out there in the public domain somewhere?
It's one of the leaked Majestic documents. In other words, in 1999 was when it was first released to Tim Cooper, who is someone that has released a number of Majestic 12 documents to the public. He released it to Robert and Ryan Woods, who are the founders of the Majestic documents, and they subjected it to some pretty stringent forensic analysis. I mean, they are really top-notch document analysts. I mean, they do the forensic analysis of all of their Majestic documents. And the thing about this memo, this burned memo, was that it was an original carbon copy. So they could subject it to some of the most stringent forensic analysis because many of their other Majestic documents are photocopies. And so there's really only so far they can go with forensic analysis with a photocopy in terms of, you know, looking at, you know, the watercolour that was used in the paper, trying to date the paper and so forth. But with this carbon copy of this burned memo, that they had an original that had been released to them. And the story was that basically this document, it was part of a series of documents that was scheduled to be burned after James Jesus Angleton's death in 1987. Angleton was chief of counterintelligence, and after his retirement, a lot of documents, I guess, he just kind of held on to those. I can talk more about what exactly he did in counterintelligence. But one of the people that worked with him in counterintelligence at the CIA was there when the documents from Angleton's files were being burned after his death in 87. And he basically took this document, this is what he says in a cover letter to Timothy Cooper. He says he basically took this document out of the fire and held on to it, and then eventually sent it on to Tim Cooper, who he knew was working with Robert Woods, and said, here's something that you will find interesting. And of course, Tim Cooper forwarded it on to Robert Woods, who did the forensic analysis, and basically was able to determine that this was indeed a historic. This was a document that could be dated to the Kennedy administration, so in that sense, it's an authentic 1960s document. It was the watercolour was an authentic government watercolour that was used in those days. And I did speak to Ryan Wood about the forensic analysis that they did on that burned memo, and he said that they have not been able to find at this stage which of the CIA watercolour documents was used for this particular burn memo, but they're very sure that it is, that it was something that was used by the CIA, but they haven't found the exact watercolour. And they're looking to do more investigation into different watercolours that were used in CIA documents. But that's just the forensics of the documents. I mean, and I can talk about the content of that document.
Well, we're going to do that when we come back from the break. We've got a break coming up here in about 20 seconds. But just again, this is a memo written by Alan W. Dulles prior to no, well, prior, prior, long time prior to November 12th, ensuring that under no circumstances would any U.S. president or his staff gain access to classified UFO files. I want to talk about that as well. All right, we're going to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and to my guest, Dr. Michael Sala. Now, Dr. Sala, when we went away for break, we had just begun diving into this memo by Alan Dulles. First of all, let me get your thoughts on this. What's the deal with a CIA director deciding that the President of the United States can be barred from knowing about what's in certain files?
Well, if the document itself is accurate, then it's quite clear that at the time of Dulles, that the director of the CIA and the head of the Majestic 12 Special Studies Group was, in fact, Alan Dulles, that they were one and the same. So MJ-1, that was the title of the person who was the chair of the Majestic 12 group, was the same as the director of Central Intelligence. That is on the burned memo itself. And as to how the burned memo arose, I mean, what sparked it, I believe that it was an initiative by Kennedy in June of 1961. So this is 5 months after he began his office in June of 61. Kennedy issued a memo to the director of the CIA, Dulles, asking Dulles to basically review Majestic 12 Special Studies Project activities with regard to psychological warfare. That was another document, a National Security Action Memo released by Kennedy back in June of 1961. And the important thing about that is because that is referred to in the actual burned memo, because in the burned memo, Dulles says that, and he refers to Kennedy using his Secret Service code word, which was Lancer. Lancer was the code word for President Kennedy, and Dulles referred to Lancer in this memo addressed to six other members of the Majestic 12 Special Studies Group, and basically saying that Lancer has begun making inquiries concerning our activities, and under no circumstances should this be released, and that his inquiries threaten the existence of the group.
Okay, now let's pause right there, and let me focus again on the central question here. The central question being, where does this idea come from that the director of CIA does not have to obey the president? Where does that come from? I mean, am I sort of naive here? It's my estimation that the people of the country elect a president and that office has certain powers. He appoints the person who's going to be the director of CIA. The director of CIA then answers to the president and gets his paycheck from us, and we've appointed the president to be his supervisor. What's the deal with, we're not going under any circumstances to allow the president to inquire into our activities? Where does this come from? Is this not an attack upon the Constitution itself?
Unfortunately, I wouldn't say it is that. I mean, there are these special access programs that have classification procedures that are developed through the projects and through executive orders. And there was a special compartmented executive order issued by President Truman and similar ones by Eisenhower, which authorized the Majestic 12 Special Studies Group to basically take control of the UFO issue and to determine who would be given need-to-know access to these files.
Well, I've made this point on this show before, and I think I made it last time you were here. If a president issues an executive order that gives life to a program like MJ-12, another president, I mean, it gets its life, it derives its life from an executive order. Now, an executive order is not the same as when the Pope speaks ex cathedra. It doesn't last forever. Another executive can sign an executive order that changes or nullifies a previous executive order. And it would seem to me that they would understand this and would know that you have to be responsive to the president.
Right. Well, you know, we need to bear in mind what President Eisenhower said at his farewell address in 61, that beware of the military-industrial complex. And I think that was an oblique way of basically saying that the overall authority over these UFO projects had been taken away from the chief executive, that even though Truman and Eisenhower were the ones that authorized these initial special compartmented executive orders that set up the system whereby the Majestic 12 group would actually run the projects concerning UFOs and extraterrestrial life, that eventually they had the authority to determine who would have access to the very, you know, not only to the files, but also to the information in the executive orders themselves. So you can imagine the difficulties someone like President Kennedy would have in trying to get to the bottom of the UFO issue if he says, well, show me the executive orders concerning this topic, and he is basically told you don't have access.
Yeah, well, I had this conversation today. I showed your articles to a friend of mine, and we discussed them today. And I'll tell you, I think it's just this simple. The president calls in the director of CIA and says, I want the information about UFOs. The director of CIA says, sorry, Mr. President, you don't have the clearance to get that information. The president says, fine, you're fired. Next, you bring in the number two guy and you say, you are now the acting director of CIA. I want the information on the UFO files. Sorry, Mr. President, you don't have the clearance. Fine, you're fired. Bring in the third guy. And you keep going until you get the information that you are requesting. I think the people of the country expect the president to have the power to get the information that he thinks he needs for whatever reason he thinks he needs it. And those who deny him that information are denying the American people what they voted for.
Well, it's very interesting you mention that, because that is in fact what happened with Kennedy and Dulles. That Kennedy did issue a National Security Action Memo in June of 1961 asking Dulles for a review of MJ-12 special group operations. He did ask them to basically tell him, you know, what are you doing? What have you been doing historically? And in October of 61, Dulles replied with his own memo, basically giving Kennedy the runaround, basically giving him this information about UFOs being things that have been studied, you know, through Project Blue Book, but basically giving him the kind of very public runaround of UFOs and not giving him the real meat in terms of what's been happening. And in this Byrne memo, you actually have an explicit statement there saying that when any member of MJ-12 is asked by any officer within the executive branch of government concerning UFOs, that you are supposed to direct the question elsewhere. So, for example, if the NASA administration, a NASA administrator is asked about UFO, or maybe a better example might be the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, who was a member of the MJ-12 committee. If he is asked by any executive officer about UFOs, he is supposed to direct the question elsewhere. He's supposed to say, well, you should go ask the NASA administrator, or you should go ask the director of the CIA. And under no circumstances are these MJ-12 members to acknowledge that this UFO issue is real, that they are basically to just direct the question elsewhere.
All right, there is another thing that you mentioned here in your article that really caught my attention. And it's where you refer to a top-secret NSA intercept of a hotline conversation between President Kennedy and Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev, dated November 12, 1963. All right, that means that the NSA had tapped the telephone line between the president and the premier of the Soviet Union, which was supposed to be a secure line for these two leaders to be able to talk and to avert any type of nuclear exchange. And here we're being informed of a telephone tap on that allegedly secure line.
Right. Well, yeah, I guess that shows you just that even a hotline between the president and the Soviet premier wasn't immune to the NSA monitoring it. But it is a very important transcript. I mean, it's a very important record. In a way, they've done us a service by recording it and actually providing a transcript of that conversation.
So do you think maybe they had permission to be intercepting that?
That I'm not sure. You know, what is the status of hotline conversations between the president and any other foreign leader? You know, whether it was accepted that their respective spy agencies would be monitoring it. I would think that they might have expected it, but I'm not sure whether this was something Kennedy was aware of.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, it's important that that conversation, we have a record of that, because it does confirm that was in those very days, and in fact it was probably that very conversation on November 12 that Kennedy and Khrushchev had basically finalized the broad agreement on how to cooperate in their joint space missions and sharing UFO files, and also importantly in that hotline conversation, they also talked about instructing their respective working group, UFO working groups, to release the information. So basically, they are expecting that the equivalent of MJ-12 in the Soviet Union at the time would also release its files to the U.S. And that was something that was an important development in that hotline agreement that they reached.
All right. Now, Dulles was on his way out. He knew he was in hot water with President Kennedy over the Bay of Pigs fiasco. And this was basically a CIA war where they sort of went around Kennedy on some information, and here they're trying to do it again on UFOs. We have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Dr. Michael Sala, the founder of exopolitics.org. Now, Dr. Sala, I said just before we went to break, you know, you had with the Bay of Pigs fiasco, disaster, you had people in the intelligence community like Alan Dulles, essentially going around Kennedy, treating the president as an inconsequential, and found out that he was not inconsequential, and they thought they could just tell him he's got to supply air support for the invasion of Cuba, and that he would have to do it, and because it was already underway. Well, he didn't do it. And So Dulles knew he was in trouble. But, I mean, there you have a thing that has caused him to be in trouble, and here he is doing it again, going around the president, abrogating the authority of the president, and saying, under no circumstances are we going to give the president information about UFOs. It's not a very smart man.
Well, I mean, it sounds like he's a very bitter man, and I think there's good reason to understand why he was bitter in terms of, obviously, he was someone that knew his time was limited. I mean, after the Bay of Pigs fiasco, as you pointed out, Kennedy was very upset and basically told Dulles his time was up, and he only had a few months to serve before he would be replaced. And of course, I think what happened was that when Kennedy asked for the information on the MJ-12 activities in June of 61, which is 2 months after the Bay of Pigs, Dulles was in no mood to give him any of this information. And then he basically began a process of communicating with other members of the Majestic 12 group in terms of how to deal with Kennedy's inquiries into the UFO issue, and that's when this burned memo arose. It's a draft set of directives that was drafted by MJ-1, which was Dulles at the time, and that he asked for the six other members that this was addressed to for feedback. And so I'm not.
So he didn't send it to all 12. He just sent it to six.
That's right. Yes, MJ-1 to MJ-7. So it was only six additional members to Dulles. It may be that those other six members were just purely the military people. I'm not sure who they were, but certainly it would be something that needs further investigation, because essentially what happened was that Dulles drafted this in September of 1961. He asked for comments by October of 61, and then Dulles retired in November of 61. So we are talking about literally the last couple of months of Dulles' tenure as Director of Central Intelligence, and he was finalizing with the other members of MJ-12 how to deal with, you know, what I think they would have regarded as a troublesome president. Basically make sure that he, and it wasn't just Kennedy, it was also Kennedy's national security staff, it was also the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Any senior official in the chief executive would be denied access to the MJ-12 documents and to the UFO files. So this was what was stipulated in this burned memo.
These guys really believed they had the right to deny the elected president of the United States, the commander-in-chief, they had the right to deny him information he was requesting. Now, I mean, I think that is a pretty clear point that they, at that point in time, they believed this. But, you know, it's a very short step from believing that you have the right to deny something to the president. It's a short step from there to believing you have the right to manufacture evidence for the president. And I wonder how much really flawed evidence has been given to presidents over the years simply from that point of arrogance.
Well, that's right. I think that these people that hold those appointments in these compartmentalized projects, they have all of the authority. They believe that because of these executive orders that were issued during the Truman administration and Eisenhower administration, that they have the authority to determine who is and who isn't given access, and that goes for all the members of the executive branch of government, including the president himself. And it's interesting here that I mentioned Truman a few times because I think Truman's role is very interesting because you might recall that Truman in the 1960 Democratic convention actually withdrew. He said that he could not support Kennedy, that he thought that Kennedy was not a good choice to be the Democratic nominee. So this was unprecedented that a former Democratic president would actually come out and say that the person who had won the most primary votes ought not be given the Democratic nomination, and he actually walked out of the Democratic convention. He didn't participate in that. And that I think is very significant because I think that's a warning sign that Truman was still someone that was in the loop. He was still someone that was regarded as kind of one of these wise men. That's the way those majestic projects work. They have these people that are nominated as wise men. And if Truman thought that Kennedy was not someone to be trusted, I think that would have encouraged these people not to share the information with Kennedy. And so I think it's well worth looking at, you know, what was the role that Truman had still with the Majestic 12 group at that time.
Well, and one wonders what is the role of every living former president. It's hard to believe, even though they say they are now just a citizen like everyone else, it's hard to believe that having served as the most powerful man on earth, that they walk away from it and have no connections. Maybe they do, but it's hard to believe that. And frankly, I don't believe it. I think they are all still very connected and have a tremendous influence, even though they are no longer the elected president. But, you know, it really doesn't matter. How can I say this? It should not matter what any former president or any other people like senators, congressmen, it shouldn't matter what they think about the president because it's the people that elected the president. And everyone that is an elected official who doesn't like the president needs to back off and realize that the real owners of the country have elected that president. Now, I'll give you an example here of how I think this works. My least favorite president of all times was Jimmy Carter. I thought he was the worst president I've ever seen in my entire life. That's a personal opinion. I know there are people that think he was a great president. I thought he was the worst we ever had. But while he was the president, whether I voted for him or not, he's my president. He's the president of my country and deserves my support. And I think a lot of Americans are in that basket. A lot of us think, okay, I didn't vote for this guy, but he got elected. And now that's all over with. He is the president. That makes him my president. Let's get behind him and try to make this successful. A lot of us are in that position. And in a very real sense, I was not a Bill Clinton supporter, but I got behind Bill Clinton after he was elected and did everything I could to try and do my little part to make sure things succeeded. But what you're describing here in the CIA is exactly the flip side of that, where they're doing everything they can to keep this president from even knowing what the issue is all about here.
Exactly, and that's unfortunately the case. I mean, we've been talking about Dulles, but I want to kind of like fast forward a little bit.
Well, let's fast forward after this break. After this break, we've got a long time before the next break. All right, folks, we'll be back right after this. right. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Dr. Michael Sala. We're talking about a possible connection between the assassination of President John F. Kennedy and his inquiries into the UFO files. When we went away for break, Dr. Sala, you were about to say that it was not just this group of people and this president, but there's been a follow-on.
Well, that's right. We were talking about Alan Dulles giving Kennedy the runaround when Kennedy asked for a review of MJ-12 activities. Mm-hmm. It also happened with McCone and especially James Jesus Angleton as the head of the counterintelligence at the CIA. The memorandum that Kennedy issued on November 12 of 1963 was to the director of the CIA, McCone. And in a footnote, or in the handwriting below that, it has the handwriting of William Colby, who later on became the director of the Center of Intelligence, but at the time was the head of the Far East Asia Division of the CIA, that Colby said that Angleton has the MJ-12 directive. And basically what that was saying was that Kennedy's request to the director of the CIA to declassify or to release UFO files to NASA so that NASA could cooperate with the Soviet Union on outer space, that this was referred on to James Jesus Angleton, CIA counterintelligence, and that it was Angleton who made the final decision as to how this would be followed. And of course, 10 days later, Kennedy is assassinated. And the interesting thing here is that Angleton, as the head of counterintelligence of the CIA, knew Oswald, that Oswald actually was someone that was being closely monitored by the CIA because he was one of the very, very few American communist defectors. He actually defected to the Soviet Union, and when he returned back to the U.S., he was being closely monitored by CIA counterintelligence, which was Angleton. So you have the same man who's monitoring Angleton, basically responding to, or you know, is the person who is dealing with Kennedy's request to get UFO files declassified, and that 2 days before Kennedy's assassination, Colby acknowledges that Angleton has the MJ-12 directive. And that is basically, I believe, smoking gun evidence that, in fact, Angleton was implementing the MJ-12 directives concerning how to deal with an American president wanting to find out about the UFO issue.
All right, let's delve into that. What is the MJ-12 directive about how to deal with a president that wants to delve into the UFO issue?
Right. Well, there were a number of directives in this burned memo, the draft memo, and the one that is most pertinent to what we are talking about is a very cryptic memo. It's called Project Environment. And basically, it's a very cryptic memo that basically says that, well, when the environment in Washington is non-conducive to growth, and Washington it does not respond to our requests, it needs to be wet. Now, that's a very cryptic statement.
No, it's not. Not really.
Okay.
Let me tell you, everyone who's ever been associated in any way with military or police or with intelligence services understands that. A wet order means assassination.
Right, exactly. And you could probably explain it better than I. I mean,
A shot in the head is excessively bloody. When you shoot someone in the head, there is pardon me, folks, but I mean, if you're squeamish, don't listen. But when someone is shot in the head, there is a massive gusher of blood. And so a wet order is an assassination order.
Exactly. So this was one of the directives that was part of this burned memo that had been authorized by Dulles together with six other members of the MJ-12 Special Studies Group, and that this directive, this MJ-12 directive, was actually being applied, was actually being implemented by Angleton as the head of counterintelligence of the CIA. And so you have here what I believe, and a few others, Dr. Robert Wood has also done quite a bit of work on the Byrne memo in terms of the forensics and also looking at the implications of this, of the assassination directive. And he believes also that this was, in fact, a clear assassination directive. That what we have here is very clearly a directive that had been authorized by MJ-12 and the Director of Central Intelligence, Dulles, back in 1961, that pre-authorized assassination if Kennedy became, if Kennedy was making it too difficult for MJ-12 to operate in Washington. And so that assassination directive is quite clear in terms of, you know, how it cryptically is saying that, yes, Washington has become non-cooperative. It's non-conducive for the growth of MJ-12 there. And so this is an assassination directive. And, of course, we have 10 days after the November 12 directive the November 12 memorandum that we actually have the Kennedy assassination, and of course Angleton's role is very important here, because I think they chose Lee Harvey Oswald for some very important reasons, because he being the patsy and being a former Soviet defector that was known to counterintelligence, they also had a very convenient rationale for why there wouldn't be a very thorough investigation into the Kennedy assassination.
You know, you've probably, like most of us, seen the Zapruder film over and over and over. That's the only one they ever show on television. It is not the only one that existed. All film back then, they didn't have video cameras, so people were shooting with 8mm film. All film that was sent for developing, it all had to be developed, was scanned or looked at, and anything that was from Dealey Plaza was confiscated, and only one or two of the films escaped that. The Zapruder film is the one they chose to show to the public. The Italians, their version of the of our intelligence services, came up with one of the films. The Zapruder film is shot with Zapruder's back towards the school book depository and facing out toward the street. But across the street, there is someone who is filming back towards the school book depository. And quite amazingly, in that film that the Italians have, you can see Lee Harvey Oswald's face very clearly in the crowd at the door, peeking out of the school book depository at the time the shots were fired. And I know about this because I watched a documentary called The Two Kennedys. It's about the two Kennedy brothers and their assassinations. And that film is in there. But in the Zapruder film, if you notice, after the shot is fired, then the Secret Service starts running up from behind to get to the presidential car. There's no Secret Service around that car. And at the time the shots are fired, the Secret Service left the car as it turned onto the street where the assassination took place. After the shots were fired, they ran back up to the car. Obviously, someone with a lot of power, very high up, had to make the decision that Secret Service was going to get off of that car.
Exactly. I think this is really part of the context that we need to look at very closely in terms of understanding how the CIA was involved in this, how the CIA had arranged for Lee Harvey Oswald to be present at the location that he was. I think the Garrison investigation did as good a job as could be expected to link Oswald to the CIA, and we know specifically that the CIA counterintelligence were monitoring Oswald closely once he returned to the U.S. back in 1962. And so Oswald is in position, and then you have the assassination. Oswald is seen, as you mentioned in the film, standing there just watching. He's not upstairs performing a role in the assassination itself. And it's quite clear that there was a very systematic effort to pin the blame on Oswald. And I think there was a number of people that talked about international media getting background on Oswald, and that he had committed the assassination even while people were still searching for him, and that you mentioned the policeman that had been killed, supposedly by Oswald. That again, it was the blame was pinned on Oswald. And I think Oswald's role...
Yeah, but listen, there were eyewitnesses to Officer Tippett's murder, and they did not describe the suspect in the same as Oswald. They described someone that was shorter, stockier, and had longer hair, and had brown skin.
Right, so there was very clearly an effort to pin the blame on Oswald, and so... You know, this is part of the overall conspiracy. But then, you know, we look at, well, why Oswald? Why him? And it was clear that CIA counterintelligence knew that Oswald was a defector from the he had defected to the Soviet Union and then returned to the U.S. And so, someone knew that by pinning the blame on Oswald, not only did you have a patsy that all the attention could focus on him, but you also had a very effective way in preventing any thorough congressional investigation, because
everyone on the Warren Commission had links to the CIA, including Gerald Ford.
Right, and Alan Dulles actually sat on the Warren Commission. He was one of the members.
Mm-hmm.
And so Dulles and other members of the Warren Commission could say, look, this guy Oswald did it. He's a communist defector. He was obviously following Soviet orders. If we go public with this, there'll be a nuclear war, and we cannot have a third world war coming out of this. So we just have to not do a thorough investigation. Just leave it at what we know, that Oswald did it, and leave it at that. And I think that was a very effective strategy. And when you look at it, it has all the kind of signs of a CIA counterintelligence operation.
All right. Now, you ended this article with a statement that says, "To be continued, part 6. And then what it says after that is, "Documents reveal CIA counterintelligence chief ordered Kennedy assassination to stop UFO files release." What document or documents are we talking about that reveal that Angleton ordered the Kennedy assassination to stop UFO information release?
Okay, there's two main documents. One is the National Security Action Memo of November 12, where Angleton... Colby mentions that Angleton has the MJ-12 directive. So that's So that's one document that acknowledges Angleton has the directive, the MJ-12 directive. And then we have the burned memo, which is another document that actually gives the assassination directive. That is the MJ-12 directive. Well, it's one of a number of directives.
Okay, now tell us again that statement about Project Environment and what it says about the way to handle it is with a wet order or something like that.
Okay, well, that was one of the MJ-12 directives that is part of the draft document or the memo that was burned and then eventually released. And it has in there this directive regarding what happens when the... and I'll read it out. Quote, when conditions become non-conducive for growth in our environment and Washington cannot be influenced any further, the weather is lacking any precipitation. It should be wet, end quote. And I think that's, as far as a cryptic directive is concerned, that's pretty clear that when political leaders in Washington are no longer cooperating and the growth of the MJ-12 organization is threatened, that it should be wet. It's an assassination order.
It sure sounds like it. I mean, considering the audience to which it's written and the sort of atmosphere and environment in which it's written, it certainly sounds like that. Now, if this was in a book about gardening, you could make an argument that that's not an assassination order. But this is not a book about gardening. It's a directive related to not being able to influence the leaders in Washington. And it certainly sounds as if that is an assassination order. Now, before I open up the telephone lines, I want us to get to this. We will have another break coming up here in about 7 minutes. But I want us to get to this and explore it, and then we'll open the phone lines. Is this very dangerous and very ominous and very, in my opinion, un-American, unconstitutional set of circumstances still in play? Does this still exist?
I think we need to look at it at a number of levels. One is that what happened was not only unconstitutional, but a crime it stands up there in terms of criminal acts of the 20th century to assassinate a president that was seeking to gain access to documents that he had a lawful right to. The other level here is that the organization that authorized this had the authority to do so and actually... believed that had the authority to do so and actually had senior CIA officials implement those directives. So that's another level that is very disturbing.
Well, look, I want to examine that a little bit. How can they believe they have the authority to assassinate a president? How can they possibly believe that? Okay, so there's something that they sort of hang their hat on in some executive order from a previous president. That means that the previous president, maybe without intending to, has issued the assassination order of the sitting president.
Well, it's a kind of indirect consequence, isn't it, or an unintentional consequence. Even though Truman and Eisenhower did in good faith authorize these special compartmented executive orders that did give Majestic 12 the authority to make all these decisions concerning UFOs and extraterrestrial life, that by no means did they ever intend that would authorize this organization to pass directives that would be used to assassinate a future president.
I don't think he intended it that way. But I'm saying that that's the effect of it. The effect of it is that his executive order is being used as the basis to say we have the authority to assassinate this president. And that's just absolutely insane. I mean, the guys who sit around the table and come up with that sort of an interpretation have been drinking left-handed Kool-Aid way too much.
Well, I agree with you. And the problem was, of course, that the person who I believe, and I think a few others believe, actually implemented that assassination directive, James Jesus Angleton, did not believe that it was unconstitutional to do so. I think that he probably believed that he was just following the directive of MJ-12, and that he was going to do it regardless of the constitutional issues involved. And I think that's what he did. And he had the authority to do it. And then he had the support of other senior CIA officials or former CIA officials in basically covering it all up.
So then what took place here was a coup led by no more than 12 people, probably not even the full 12, maybe just the top six. A coup that replaced the regime in the United States.
I think you're correct. I think that is exactly what happened here, that Kennedy did finally confront this this organization, MJ-12, all the authority it had secretly acquired or accumulated under previous presidents, and Kennedy confronted its power and tried to basically get that power back to the chief executive of the United States. And that he was essentially assassinated, and that there was, exactly as you just said, a political coup that occurred, that President Kennedy was assassinated.
Oh, it was more than a political coup. I mean, we had a murder that took place, so it was not just political. We had a murder that took place, and these guys, if indeed... And I have to say it this way because, you know, nobody's been convicted of any of this. So I have to say, if indeed it happened as you say, assuming that it happened that way, then we have six people who took over this government.
I think that is pretty close to being exactly what happened, that the seven people that signed that directive, that draft directive, that that signed it eventually and authorized it, that they have taken over by virtue of the fact that CIA counterintelligence under Angleton chose to implement that directive. And I don't think, I mean, even though they issued the directive, and it was an assassination directive, I think it was because Angleton implemented it that we actually had the coup.
Well, I got to tell you, that's an angle on the Kennedy assassination I have never previously considered. And I also have to tell you that it is most disturbing, really disturbing. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll open the phone lines for you folks to call in with your questions and comments. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Dr. Michael Sala, and I want to open up the telephone lines because I know many of you across this country, across Canada, the UK, Europe, Africa, Asia, Australia, want to call and talk with Dr. Sala about this bombshell information. The telephone number is 480-553-7232. Again, 480-553-7232. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Hello, caller. All right. Again, 480-553-7232. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. It's Terry from Ohio.
Hi, Terry.
Hi. Yeah, yeah, like you said, most people who are military knows what all that means. That, you know...
Terry, have you served in the military?
Well, no, but police or whatever, mm-hmm. Secret, private security.
Yeah, it's a pretty out-in-the-open term when they talk about a wet order.
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody knows what that is.
My concern is, like, I know that you talk quite vehemently about not adding politics into the solution of disclosure.
No, I don't. What I say is that on the show we don't get into politics. Politics has to do with the Republicans are proposing this and it's not right, or the Democrats are proposing this and it's not right. That's politics. Just because you mention a president's name or just because you mention something that's going on, that's not politics. Look, if I happen to mention that one of the greatest thinkers in the world was a guy named Moses, is that religion? No.
No.
And so, no, there's no politics involved in this discussion. What we're talking about here is the murder of a president, the coup that took place, apparently, and its connection to UFOs.
Yeah, exactly. That's what concerns me with anyone with eyes to see and ears to hear continue to go along with this farce, which is what's called our government. I believe that Kennedy was our last real president. And ever since then, it's just, gotten worse. And since then, that are under our government or our politics or people who are running us, it's just like Texas Hold'em. They done pushed all in, and now we're sitting here, deciding whether we're going to hold them, or call. And, unless we want this country back, we're going to have to call them.
Well, I don't know what it would take, Terry. I do know this. I do know that history, including the birth of this nation, proves that when a government becomes tyrannical, puts its foot on the throat of the people, and really pushes the people and suppresses the people come up fighting. And that's how this nation was born. That's how the French Revolution took place. Milosevic was taken down by his own people. Ceausescu was taken down by his own people. Whenever people have had enough, then things happen that restore freedom to them. They make it happen. I do not support, nor do I want to see a revolution in this country. But I'm not a fool, and I know that if they push hard enough and suppress long enough, there will be reactions.
Yeah. I just, I don't want to see that either. But, like I told you before, we're at a point, no return. And I don't think that they, that a million Iraqis being killed or 3,000 Americans being killed in a trade center and even 300 million of us in the United States would be something they'd be concerned with to maintain their quo like, I can't say it right.
Status quo?
Yes.
Well, look, you only have power when there are people subservient to you. And so getting rid of people who are subservient to you diminishes your power. I think I'm correct on that, but Dr. Sala is an expert on things like that. What do you think, Dr. Sala? Am I correct?
I think that you're quite correct that when we look at a mobilized population, that they can truly change governments and systems can be completely overhauled if you have the population mobilized. One of the things I would also add is that in successful revolutions or whatever it is that needs to be done here, there is always the need for cooperation between those outside the system who know that there's been some fundamental injustice or that it's corrupted, and those within the system who are decent people who disagree with policy. And I think we have a lot of people within the system who are familiar with the UFO issue, who are familiar with the cover-up, who are even familiar with what happened genuinely with Kennedy, who disagree with the power or with the coup that occurred. You know, and we need to be aware that many of these documents have been leaked.
And that sort of serves as a safety valve as well, in that there are people trying to get the information out to the public and who are sympathetic inside the government with disclosure. And that sort of serves as a safety valve that I sincerely hope that safety valve and some others having to do with other topics, I sincerely hope are able to keep the pressure down so that we don't see people trying to mount a revolution. Let's go back into the telephone bank here. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, it's Kevin from North Bay, Ontario.
Yeah, Kevin, speak right into your phone for us.
Hello, yes. Can you hear me good now?
We can hear you, yes.
Hello there, Michael.
Hi, Kevin.
Hello, yes. You know, when it comes to the JFK assassination, I've done some looking into it, and I've read also Jim Mars has also done a lot of work on it, too, and I've read a lot of his stuff. But Kevin, you've done you were a police officer. You've done a lot of investigation into crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do an investigation into a crime or anything, especially when you find out that the original suspect, like we have Lee Harvey Oswald, is not the guilty party, as you pointed out, the first question you then have to ask is who benefits from the assassination of the president, and that will lead you. And if you ask that question and follow the leads stemming from that, that will lead you to actually who and possibly even why that this person was assassinated.
Well, it certainly can. It does not necessarily do that, but it certainly can do that. And with Oswald, I'm not going so far as to say that he is not the guilty party. I think he was part of it. I don't think there's any question but that he was part of it, and he delivered the gun to the school book depository, or at least the evidence does seem to support that. And so he was part of the group that apparently put it all together. One thing about Lee Harvey Oswald, several things about him, you need to understand that Lee Harvey Oswald is not the goofball loner that they painted him. First of all, he was a radar technician on super top secret, special kind of radar for tracking the U-2 spy plane. And you had to be sharp to do that. He very quickly learned Russian and was fluent in Russian. That's not an easy language, I can tell you. I understand most of what I hear in Russian, but it's very difficult to speak it. And then whenever he defected, he walked into an embassy and said, "I renounce my U.S. citizenship," handed them his passport, and went to Russia. When I think it was about 2 years later, I could be wrong about that, he came back and wanted to come back to the USA. He walks into the same embassy and said that he wants to come back to the USA. They pulled his passport out of the desk and handed it back to him. Now, that isn't what happens when someone renounces their citizenship. Their passport is sent back to the State Department, and it is canceled. That isn't what happened to Lee Harvey Oswald. He was connected somewhere, some way, deep inside. And I don't think we can say that he was not the guilty party. He was a guilty party. He was part of it. But he was not the lone shooter. And that has been pretty well established. What is really interesting to me about this has to do with the fact that, Dr. Sala, you have made connections via documents to the UFO issue.
It's a very important connection, because when we look at the Kennedy assassination, the literature on that goes into a multitude of different explanations for why he was killed, but none of them really go into the UFO dimension, because simply the documents were never released. It was only with the MJ-12 documents coming forward that we get an idea of what happened. And the Byrne memo, that only came out in probably the last few years. And so with that, we get a much more accurate idea of what was going on. And another document that I didn't mention, and this kind of casts kind of more light on what was going on, was that the Marilyn Monroe, that she was also assassinated because she was going to go public on Kennedy having knowledge on UFOs, traveling to an Air Force base to view extraterrestrial bodies and crashed vehicles. And the interesting thing was that the CIA document, which was a summary of a wiretap involving Marilyn Monroe and Robert Kennedy and some of the people that she was communicating with, that was countersigned by none other than James Jesus Angleton. So again, you have the CIA counterintelligence monitoring Marilyn Monroe. Why was that? Again, it's the UFO connection. It's like Angleton had access to the UFO files.
Yeah, like total access. Listen, a break has just started. Let me ask our caller who is on hold, are you willing to hang on through the break?
Sure.
All right, hang on. We'll be back to you and to Dr. Sala right after this. Don't go away, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, hi, Kevin. This is Ryan in Washington.
Hi, Ryan.
Yeah, I had a question. I'm sorry I missed part of the show. Dr. Saul, were you saying that the information that you wrote about regarding the hotline conversation between Kennedy and Khrushchev, was that... Were you deriving that from the MJ-12 documents? I wasn't sure about that. Is that where you got it from?
Yes, the transcript that came from the MJ-12 documents, and I mentioned also a interview with Sergei Khrushchev that confirmed that indeed his father did change his mind and reach an agreement or consensus with Kennedy. Oh. At that date, so that made me confident that the hotline transcript was pretty accurate.
Oh, do you know if that specific? I'm sorry, Specifically says that it was the NSA that did that. The only reason I'm asking, I was curious because for so long the NSA was completely unknown to everybody. It was such a black program that nobody knew that the NSA existed until a certain date, which I'm not sure which date. The NSA basically became a household name, and now we all know who they are. the reason I was wondering is because whenever that document was released to Tim Cooper, it'd be kind of interesting to see if it, at that time if anybody even knew that the NSA existed, because that would kind of lend some credibility to it, you know what I mean?
Well, yes, it does say that it's an NSA intercept of the hotline communication. But I don't know when Tim Cooper got this document, when he actually received it, so we can't really confirm at this point. But I don't think it would be hard to confirm that he either got it just before the... whether the NSA had been publicly acknowledged or not. I mean, we should be able to confirm that.
Well, but you make a good point there.
It stands for no such agency. Now everybody knows that they're there. So, anyways, thanks for taking my call.
All right. That would be a very interesting thing to know, and it's a good point that he raises. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Paul from New York.
Hi, Paul.
How you doing?
Good.
That tape that you were mentioning, the two Kennedys, which showed Oswald standing outside while the shooting was taking place, it's also, I don't know if you saw this other video, the Garrison tapes, it's also in there also. I just watched it, and you could clearly see Oswald as it's going by. And
yeah, he's at the front door looking
exactly.
out.
Yeah, and I mean, it's definitely, you could clearly see him. But with Oswald, I think he was CIA from the time he was in the Marines, and I think they controlled him. That's how they got him in and out of Russia, and planned him. And you know, I really didn't think he, had any intentions of killing Kennedy. I think they kind of played him for the patsy. He didn't know he was being played. And as far as him bringing the gun up, there was also a Mauser, I think, found. Another gun, which they never mentioned, which they hid the fact that there were two guns found, not only the Calcano, but another Mauser. So, I don't think Oswald, had any intentions of killing Kennedy, but, I think he just played along by the CIA. And,
well, that may be. I at this point, I don't think we can really know what Oswald's intentions were.
Right.
And what you say may be correct. I think it is clear that he was part of the team of people that pulled this off. And so his hands are not clean here.
Yeah, but what did I want to ask Dr. Sala? I've read Colonel Fletcher Prouty's book on the Kennedy assassination, and I find him to be the most credible. He did work for Alan Dulles. He was part of the Joint Chiefs, and not once did he ever mention any motive involving UFOs or anything like that. I mean, there are plenty of other motives that I find more credible, and I think he would have been the man to know, if that was in fact the case. If the CIA did put a hit on him, which I believe they did, but I believe there were other motives. I just can't believe that it was because of the UFO thing.
May I interject a thought?
Yeah.
If I knew that this particular reason or that particular reason, whatever it may be, was the reason that the president got hit, and I was writing a book, I might lay the blame with the proper people. I might lay the blame with Angleton,
right. But
I would not tell what caused it, because if I tell what caused it, look, the president wasn't protected. I certainly could not be.
Yeah.
So as a writer and as a former cop, that's the way I would think about it. I would say, okay, I'm going to put the blame where it belongs, but I can't tell exactly why it happened, because if I do, I'm going to be hit too.
Right, right. Okay, it's just my opinion.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Just, Dr. Sala, yeah.
Well, just very quickly on Fletcher Prouty. I think with Fletcher Prouty, he is very authoritative when it comes to covert operations involving the CIA, because he was a liaison for the military supplying hardware and logistics for the CIA's covert intelligence operations. But I think when it came to the UFO issue, that he wasn't in the loop. And he never mentions UFOs, extraterrestrials, in his books. So I think it was just an area that he wasn't briefed on. And that's just to say that I think his analysis just reflects the level of briefing that he received. But with the MJ-12 documents, what we have is, I believe, genuinely leaked documents revealing the inner workings of the most secretive aspects of the U.S. national security system. And I think it really helps cast light and focus on what happened to Kennedy and why.
Yeah, and let me say this very quickly just to underscore something. The MJ-12 documents have been called into question. Their authenticity has been. I've had people on the show, guests on the show, that have defended them. I've had guests that have said they are fakes. I've had guests on that says some of them are fake, but some of them are real. And what you're relying on is if I understand it correctly, is this memorandum that's part of the MJ-12 documents, but that is also corroborated, the information anyway, is corroborated by the testimony of Khrushchev's son. And so that one, at least, appears to be accurate and authentic.
And also, there was a second National Security Action Memo issued on November 12th, and that was to James Webb, advising him to basically advising him to come up with a plan to cooperate with the Soviet Union on outer space affairs.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you, it's always interesting when you're with us. We're just about out of time. I want to thank you for being with us. This has been bombshell information. I've learned things here tonight that I had not known. And like I said, I started out by saying, oh, well, here we go. It's another Kennedy deal. Because I've read so many of them and I've heard it all my life. This was primo, I'll tell you. Thank you for being with us this evening, Dr. Sala.
Well, thank you, Kevin, for having me on the show and really having the foresight to see how important this issue is.
If you will, stay on the line with me for just a moment as I say goodbye to our audience for tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, my friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.